Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm talking to Joyce Carol Oates. She's one of the people that I've been talking to since I was 18 years old, and it's a pleasure to see her again. I can't pretend to impartiality. I read The Accursed in a single weekend. It's a magnificent, funny, terrifying, scary, intelligent, social commentary, gothic, and it's extraordinary. I want to begin by asking if you remember what the first scary book you ever read was.
Well, that's a good question. Probably it was Alice in Wonderland and Alice through the Looking Glass, which I probably talked about with you in the past. That was my first real book. And, of course, it's vivid and nightmarish. It does have humor in it, but some of the humor shades into the dark. And most of the episodes in both Alice books are nightmares. Each ends with a nightmare scene, but Alice wakes up. She doesn't succumb to terror or confusion or chaos, but she wakes up and comes back to herself.
What I particularly noticed is in this book, The Accursed, the nightmare is accompanied by a Dave version. So that Upton Sinclair, the author of The Jungle, makes an appearance, and he's aware that if he takes his eye for a second from the manuscript he's working on, it will all go. This book seems to be a connection of the nightmare realm and the human in a way that I haven't seen before in your work.
Well, that's a perception of yours. I think that consciously I wasn't aware of that, but I can see it's coming from the same place.
Marilynne Robinson, for instance, likes to speak about fiction as the continuous dream. And here it does feel like several different kinds of dreams have been interlaced, and the book's mysteriousness and its weird abundance and generosity has to do with a number of different kinds of vision in it.
Yes, I moved to Princeton in 1978, and I immediately began to be quite under the spell of the local history, which much of it is Revolutionary War history. And I went to the library and started reading, and particularly reading about Woodrow Wilson.
Who was the president of Princeton.
He was the president of Princeton University at that time. He went on to become president of the United States. But he was a man of young middle age when he was president at Princeton. And he encountered all the problems that are, some of the problems that are still at universities, like dealing with eating clubs and fraternities and sororities and people of privilege and so forth, and certain elements of political and cultural reform, which Woodrow Wilson did introduce. At the same time, I was actually astonished to read biographies of Woodrow Wilson that so admirable, and yet as a woman, as a feminist, as a person from a less than middle class background, I was astonished at his class snobbery, his sexism, which he disguised with jokes, as men did in those days, and his racism. And these are elements that are really not in the biographies or completely suppressed, because all the biographies are written by admiring white men, and of course he was a white man. So I had not really intended to create a portrait of Woodrow Wilson that's quite so exposing of his flaws, and I make him a somewhat comic person.
But he is wonderful in this book because he's so paranoid.
He's so paranoid,
of
yes.
his enemies, of the yes. people scheming against him, of the conspiracies at the university. I mean, many a university president has felt this way.
Yes.
But he's caught in a book in which Princeton has been hit by a curse. And because of his extraordinary paranoia about other things, he's the perfect person to be at the center of this book full of supernatural malfeasance.
Absolutely. And also he should be a very moral leader, a Christian leader, but he's also completely blind and indifferent to the racism that's going on in his society. And far from being a leader who'll stand up and talk, you know, critically of the Ku Klux Klan, for instance, he's actually quite cowardly.
The book begins with the report of a lynching by the cowled Klansmen, and that in itself is a gothic and horrible vision.
Yes, it's unspeakable, so they don't want to talk about it in Princeton, and basically they don't talk about it. Only the black man, Ruggles, talks about it, but nobody else wants to. So I thought of a world in which things were not spoken of, but which came back, you know, the revenge of the repressed.
It's really very much so, because it's their sexual squeamishness and avoidance as well that is repressed. And so whole aspects of experience are unnarratable in this book.
That's right. The homophobic.
Yes. And the writing replaces those elements with the supernatural.
That's right.
That cannot be said becomes a horrific serpent that rises and works its way down the throat of an orator while he's making a speech. And I was so astonished.
Well, you're such a good reader. Of course, this is not surprising. Some people have not seen that. They don't see that it's a book about the repressed and about things reemerging from the unconscious. They just see it as sort of a gothic thriller, which is not really the intention of the novel.
Well, it can be read that way enjoyably, but what is exciting is that this is a gothic with a difference.
Yes.
That is to say, its twists and turns are the twists and turns of the culture, that it joins a sequence of your novels, beginning with Bellefleur, continuing with The Mysteries of Winterthurne, and then the Bloodsmore romance, which are American histories and the way in which we take the things that are unpleasant to us and render them horrific and unapproachable. So it is American Gothic in a special way.
Yes.
Now, when you say unspeakable, are the records still retrievable of how vicious we tended to be?
Well, I think so. I've looked at Woodrow Wilson's letters. It's more a matter of what's left out. But one of the remarks of Woodrow Wilson that I put in my novel that I came upon, it was so extraordinary. He was making some ludicrous, comical statement that something would never, ever happen. He said, "Not until there is a Negress in the White House." And I thought, wow, what a statement for him to make.
And he's saying that that'll happen when hell freezes over. Yes.
And it's so, well, first of all, of course, he was a racist, but also a misogynist. But also, this was meant to elicit howls of laughter, a Negress in the White House. But of course, today, we have Michelle Obama in the White House. So it's a wonderful irony to be writing this novel, publishing it in 2013, and it's about the racism and bigotry and blindness of 1905.
Well, when you began it, it was in the 1980s.
That's right.
It was the fourth of the series of Gothics. I guess the newest thing is its narrator-editor. What gave you his tone?
The tone of the narrator I did not have immediately. It was more 19th century originally. And because the voice of the narrator was never quite right, that's why I didn't revise the novel until 2 years ago. It was 2 years ago that I went back to the material with a lot of enthusiasm and excitement, and I thought, now I can do it. Maybe it had to do with Obama being elected. Maybe it had to do with just the fact that Princeton University is so different now with women and a woman president. But I was just a whole new era. It was as if some different lights had been turned on in the room, and I had now a voice that moved a little faster. It wasn't 19th century. And a voice, unconsciously funny voice of a person who means well, but he's also a bigot.
Well, not only a bigot, he's an egotist.
He's an egotist.
He's managed to acquire in mysterious ways the secret manuscripts that were not available of what was once unspeakable.
That's right. So
he tells us about a code journal that he's acquired in which a woman invalid suffering from, quote, female problems who's witnessing her husband turning.
All
husbands turn.
Yeah, they all do. Eventually.
And he protests, this husband, that he loves her, and one assumes, in a sense, that he does, but it's not a form that anyone can accept from love, nor is her imagining herself almost in retaliation. She likes to allow herself to be called pussy, and she treats herself as an invalid, testing medicines and cures, and yet she thinks, maybe I could dress and go out. I actually couldn't.
Could maybe, yes.
Yes.
She's so pampered. And also, to be an invalid, if you're a woman in those years, a nurse than a woman, you were relieved of all the duties of being a real woman. You didn't even have to put on your corsets and your clothes. You could lie in your chaise lounge and have tea, and your women friends could visit you, and you could eat chocolates, and you could read the latest novel by Edith Wharton, or a book by Madame Blavatsky.
Or Marie Corelli.
Marie Corelli. So she's having actually a good time, and I thought of her as being just the quintessence of this useless upper class society where there is no social value in her at all. But I quite liked her because she was so catty and so nasty and funny.
Yes, and so does the editor like her. He likes getting to her witty wickedness.
Her witty wickedness. And then when she's really idle, she writes a nasty letter using somebody else's handwriting.
Yes. I'm talking to Joyce Carol Oates about her novel, The Accursed, which I was engrossed, horrified by, made merry at, couldn't believe sometimes the things that were happening in this book. It went so far, you know, to really raise the hatchet against the kind of male-dominated, overweight, older man society with their hatred of aliens, of women, of blacks, of Jews, of homosexuals, you name it.
Yes.
It goes so far that these things become unspeakable, and the unspeakable becomes the source of terror.
That's right. It's like people today who are very conservative, say fundamentalist Christians or religious people, who are trying to stop progress. They don't believe in same-sex marriage. They don't believe in women having children without being married, or lesbians living together. They don't believe in those things, but they can't stop them. It's like the nightmare has completely unleashed and the dikes are broken. But in 1905-06, it looked as if maybe you could hold the line against these things if you've just made enough laws and arrested enough people.
Well, it's fascinating because a university, of course, is a place where young people can be patrolled, dominated, indoctrinated, and, you know, put under vigilant scrutiny. And so it's, in a way, a perfect version of a benign police state.
That's right.
With Mr. Woodrow Wilson at its head, educating the children of the privileged in a new generation of repression, which masks itself, this is the scariest, as idealism.
Absolutely. And then President Patton, another president, said of the university and also of the theological seminary that we have no new ideas here. That was a boast, and that was something he was saying to assure the parents. We have no new ideas here.
Yes, they
promise. Isn't
that
shocking?
Yes,
they
we
promise.
Will not be teaching.
No new ideas.
Well, isn't that the parallel to the creationist argument?
Absolutely. It's the same sort of thing because Darwinian evolutionary theory was just, you know, roiling and boiling at this time around the turn of the century. And younger people, younger scientists understood it. Older people pretended to understand it, and they were repudiating it, but they actually have never really understood Darwin.
There's an undercast here of literary people. There's Jack London, the great, I still love reading Jack London, I have to say.
Yes, he is wonderful.
The author of The Sea Wolf and Call of the Wild. There's Upton Sinclair, the author of The Jungle. There's Mark Twain, who shows up on vacation in Bermuda.
I love him.
Yes, I do too.
I had to put him in.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's marvelous. And Mr. Woodrow Wilson goes to Bermuda to get away from his hypochondria and his paranoia and his state of constant terror. And there he acquires a mistress, or seems to.
Seems to. And that really happened.
Did it?
It really happened. We don't know exactly what went on, but he did have this woman friend. He had some kind of an affair with him, side by side with writing these cloying, sweet letters to his wife every day.
Which are hilarious. You do a daily letter from Woodrow Wilson.
And they're real letters. I mean, many of them are just sort of verbatim, some of the sentences. And awful poetry. The doggerel that he wrote, that was him, wasn't me.
Oh.
I couldn't write anything that bad.
I'm talking with Joyce Carol Oates. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. The book is The Accursed. We'll continue after this short break.
If you're listening to Bookworm, chances are you're a big reader. Connect with other book lovers. Join our virtual book club on Facebook. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm for more info. Thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Joyce Carol Oates about her new novel, The Accursed, a gothic tale with a twist in which the narrator serves as a historical detective uncovering a supernatural early 20th century world. Now, how many different kinds of demons, can you name them, appear in the book? There are vampires.
Well, vampires, and then demons that represent people's projections, like the sort of the antithesis of oneself, let's say. And then in one scene, a person who greatly admires A. Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes novels and short stories. He looks out his window, and who's coming to see him but Sherlock Holmes makes a surprise visit. And it's as if these very neurotic people are feeding their egos, but the demons flatter them and the demons single them out. The demons know how weak they are. My first image of the novel was of a beautiful young woman who represents the quintessence of the ruling class, and she's conventionally blonde and beautiful, and she's somebody's daughter, obviously, and she is going to be taken away from her bridegroom by this other dark, freakish bridegroom who represents all the things that are not spoken of. But she sees him as a desirable man, even though the world looks upon him as if he had like a frog face and he's sort of like a fairy tale deformity of a man. But when she looks at him, she sees a handsome suitor. That was my initial idea for the novel, and then, of course, many other things were layered around it. And Annabelle then, she makes no decisions for herself, and she had no will, and she's basically a pawn. She's taken from her father's world into this other world, and she's literally in the underworld, in the bog kingdom, and then she makes her way back. But by the end of the novel, she has some autonomy, and she's actually left Princeton. But near the end of the novel, some of the women are actually making decisions based upon their knowledge, and basically they're leaving their comfortable class structure and striking out for a different kind of life.
And we watch everywhere as the rules governing sexism, racism, becoming both the consciousness and the repression of the culture, which makes the book a very liberating book. We do see how far we've come, even if we may feel it's baby steps.
Well, that's true. I think we have come so far. It's really exciting. And like the young people at the end of the novel have moved away, and they're living in a commune, essentially. But also Woodrow Wilson, with all his faults, when he's put to this test, would he want his nemesis and rival to die of a stroke? And he thinks about it, and he says, no. He doesn't go that far. So he is actually drawing back. He's not as evil as he might have been. He is a stubborn person. He doesn't really want his nemesis to die. He doesn't go that far. So even Woodrow Wilson, in his in his way, behaves like a hero.
At the end of this book, there's a sermon, and it's almost inspired by a man's wonder at his understanding that God is not listening, and that nothing said to, for, at, prayed to this God can have the slightest effect whatever. And the piece, all in capital letters, around 15 pages, feels entranced. Is there a part of your writing that you associate with trance?
Well, it's more of a consciously structured trance. I was very sympathetic with Winslow Slade, even though he is, in a sense, the villain of the whole novel. I thought of him as the very essence of the white, the blind, unknowing white, quote, good Christian man. He thinks he's good. He doesn't understand that he isn't good, that he doesn't have a sense of humanity beyond his own class and his own skin or his own sex. These people did not really, really think that African Americans were human. You know, they might say something that might be nice to their servants, but basically they didn't think that these people should be allowed to be human, and they didn't think that women should have the vote. Now, they were nice people, and they were charitable. They gave money to charity. But basically, I think they were evil people. And so Winslow Slade comprehends that he is the curse. He's actually the cross curse himself. And then, of course, he's the sacrifice because he dies. At least he has the courage to acknowledge that he is the evil person.
Yes, and in fact, it's moving because he's tried before to confess.
He gives
a lying confession.
He just couldn't quite make it. Yeah.
And what's hilarious is that the sins and faults are taken and kept in vaults.
Yes.
That text of that original confession has vanished. The text of the sermon has vanished.
Yes.
And now we're with the narrator, the editor, who seems has been looking constantly and swoops down upon auctions and estate sales in order to get all the forbidden documents.
Yes, yes. And he doesn't really know whether he himself might be the son of a demon. He's not sure. I mean, he doesn't talk about it, but his mother was accused by her husband of having had relations with this demon. And of course, he himself is the son of that union, but maybe the father was just paranoid and crazy, or maybe he is the son of a demon.
Yes, and there's a sense throughout that only in 1984, when this editor starts to write the novel, that the people in the novel might be able to define themselves. Because, you see, in addition to all of the isms, racism and sexism, there's a terrible ignorance. The homosexuals are not permitted to know themselves as homosexuals. The lesbians are afraid. And even if they are brave, they hide within the secrecy of the culture. One gets the feeling that this somewhat, can I say, prissy, antique collecting, obsessed narrator is on the verge of a self-discovery that manages almost successfully to elude him.
That's
but
right.
It doesn't miss the reader.
Yes. Well, the sudden situations where people are vanished or expelled still continue today. It wasn't that long ago at Princeton University. It could have been 2011, where a fairly popular and well-liked instructor who did not have tenure was just fired, and he disappeared, and he wasn't allowed to finish the term, and his students were stunned. They had no knowledge of where he had gone or why, and the university would not explain anything. It just all sort of a wall of silence. And this is very, very recent. And then after about a week or so, the students learned that he had committed suicide because of being fired. And that was completely quieted down. So if the newspaper wanted to write an article about it, there was no comment. You know, just absolutely no comment. If that's going on in the 21st century at Princeton, you can imagine what was going on in the beginning of the 20th century. So much of these sudden expulsions and no explanation. And Woodrow Wilson says in one of the chapters called The Unspeakable, well, as it is unspeakable, we can't speak of it. And someone says, well, shouldn't these expelled boys be able to defend themselves? He says, no, they're gone. You know, what they have done is indefensible. Like, there's just no way to get beyond that wall.
Well, one of the, I think, thrilling scenes in this novel is the discovery that some of these deaths are illusions.
That's right.
And the youngest people are brought back to life, which seemed to me to be a very gracious and beautiful thing.
Well, they could have had that. There's a sleeping sickness where it does mimic death, and in those days, it wasn't really clear. They didn't have brain scans. If they couldn't detect a heartbeat or a breath, they assumed someone was dead. Today, you'd get a brain, you'd see whether the brain had stopped. But in those days, they didn't really know these things.
Well, hence the Edgar Allan Poe burial.
Yeah, the
burial.
Fear. Yeah.
Yes.
There was always a fear that people would be buried alive. You know, that's sometimes why there were stakes in hearts and to make sure that someone was dead. And I think the fear of the survivors that maybe they had too quickly buried somebody and the person would come back from the dead, that's maybe behind the fears of ghosts.
Wow. I've been talking with Joyce Carol Oates, the author most recently of the fantastic, very rich and dense and complex and enjoyable novel, The Accursed, published by Echo. Thank you, Joyce, for joining me.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Accursed at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Robert Dewhurst and Monica Scott. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we're just read this. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Sam Lipsight is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.